Welcome to Down Home Radio. This week we got a great interview with David Holt. David is a banjo player, really a multi-instrumentalist, and has also done a lot of great field work with older musicians over the years. A project of his that I'm going to draw from extensively today is what was released as a 3-CD set called Legacy that David did with Doc Watson. And he talks to Doc, and Doc plays a bunch of music, and they play together. It came out in 2002. It's really a great piece of work. And I'll be playing big parts of it throughout the program, so you'll hear a bunch of David's interviews with Doc Watson, as well as a lot of music from Doc and from other members of the Watson family. But we'll also be talking with David about his early experiences with the music, such as when he sought out the old early cowboy singer Carl Sprague back in the 60s in Texas, as well as a bit about his experiences with Nimrod Workman, the great ballad singer and political activist from Kentucky. And also David had a small part in the film O Brother, Where Art Thou, so I was able to get his perspectives on being a part of that project as well. As always, don't forget to check out our website, downhomeradioshow.com, for more information on this program and all our other programs. Now here's the interview. David Holt, welcome to Down Home Radio. How are you?
Glad to be here, Eli. Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get into some of the work that you've done documenting and learning from older traditional musicians, could you tell us about your own background and how you got into traditional folk music?
I'll tell you a condensed version of it.
Okay.
I grew up in Texas. My dad was an inventor, but we have five generations of bones players in my family, so that was something that always made me aware of traditional music. This is a tradition that was handed down in the family. These are just cow bones that you play as a rhythm instrument.
Sure, yeah, that's so funky. I love that stuff.
Yeah, it was pretty incredible, and that just made my ear attuned to folk music, I guess. But I was a rock and roll drummer in high school, and at one point I was about 21 years old. I got jumped and beat the crap out of and left for dead. And after that happened,
I'm sorry to hear that.
I just wasn't interested in rock and roll anymore. And I began to look in music, first old cowboy music. And I went to collect music from the first cowboy singer ever to record. His name was Carl Sprague. And he lived in Texas, and I was from Texas. And I just realized that, man, you could go to your heroes and, like, learn directly from them. I was just, a young man at that time.
How old was Carl at that, in his 60s?
Oh, more than that. He was in the 70s, I guess, at that time.
Wow.
I went to see him a few times, and he taught me how to play the harmonica, and it just made me realize the joy of learning from old-timers. I wasn't a folklore, so I didn't know how to find other cowboy singers, really.
Sure. How did you find him?
Well, when I got interested in the cowboy singing, I went to the John Edwards Memorial Foundation Archive at UCLA, and I met Kenny Goldstein. He said,
"Oh wow,
you need to go down and see this old guy. He's still alive." I told him I was looking for cowboy songs, and he was a real nice guy. And he said, "Go down and find this guy," and told me he lived in Bryan, Texas. He was easy to find.
Yeah. Well, let's pause the interview there for a second and check out some Carl Sprague. I can't resist. He's one of my favorites, so it was tough to decide which track. But let's hear "When the Work's All Done This Fall," and then we'll get back to David Holt.
A group of jolly cowboys discussing plans at ease. Says one, "I'll tell you something, boys, if you will listen, please. I'm an old cow puncher, and here I'm dressed in rags. I used to be a tough one and take on great big jags. But I have a home, boys, a good one you all know. Although I have not seen it since long, long ago. But I'm going back to Dixie once more to see them all. Yes, I'm going back to see my mother when the work's all done this fall. When I left home, boys, my mother for me cried. She begged me not to leave her, for me she would have died. My mother's heart is breaking, breaking for me, that's all. And with God's help, I'll see her when the work's all done this fall. That very night, this cowboy went out to stand his guard. The night was dark and cloudy and storming very hard. The cattle all got frightened and raced in wild stampede. The cowboy tried to head them while riding at full speed. While riding in the darkness, so loudly did he shout, trying his best to head them and turn the herd about. His saddle horse did stumble and upon him did fall. The boy won't see his mother when the work's all done this fall. Boy, send my mother my wages, the wages I have earned. For I'm afraid, boys, my last year I have turned. I'm going to a new range, I hear the master's call. And I'll not see my mother when the work's all done this fall. George, you may have my saddle, Bill, you may have my bed. Jack, you may have my pistol after I am dead. But think of me kindly as you look upon them all. For I'll not see my mother when the work's all done this fall. Poor Charlie was buried at sunrise, no tombstone at his head. Nothing but a little slab, and this is what it said. Charlie died at daybreak, he died from a fall. And he'll not see his mother when the work's all done is fall.
And then I heard that there were, you know, hundreds, thousands of musicians around the Southern Mountains back in the late 60s, and that were played old-time music, and not cowboy music, but old-time music, and that sounded interesting. So I came back here to all through the Appalachian Mountains in 1969 and just literally found everybody from Tommy Gerald to, you know, Nimrod Workman, to people playing this music, and I just thought, man, this is something I got to get be a part of. So I took up the banjo at that point and then finally moved back here when I graduated from college and just gave all my energy to learning from old-timers, realizing that this was kind of the end of this pioneer generation. These guys were like my grandparents of the same generation, and so born in the late 1800s. So they were kind of the last of that pioneer crew. They had a certain wisdom that you just really don't see anymore.
That's most excellent and wonderful that you were really in the right place at the right time.
Isn't that the truth? Yeah.
And how did the Legacy Project with Doc Watson happen? How did you get to know him?
You know, I met Doc in 1972 when I came back here in those early days, and then when I had this show on the Nashville Network called Fire on the Mountain, it was a bluegrass and mountain music show for 5 years, I guess. This is a country music cable channel that no longer actually exists anymore, but it was a show that Doc was on several times, he and Merle, and so we started working together there, and we really liked each other, and he only lives about 2 hours from me. And so over the years, we've done many performances together, and then 1998, our public television station here in North Carolina asked us to do a show for them, an hour-long public television show.
Excellent.
And so we put together a concert, and that was so popular, people started asking us to play together, and we've been doing it ever since. And the Legacy thing grew out of the conversations I like to have with Doc on stage. I try to always think of something different that I haven't asked him before, and, you know, it's you hear his stories about his fascinating life, and so I thought, man, that needs to be recorded. He's such a beautiful speaker. He almost speaks in poetry, you know.
Oh,
so
absolutely.
That's how that happened. We were playing together, and I just thought, well, we ought to have his story of his life and his life in music as well as, you know, lots of music on the CD. So it's a 3-CD set. That's the one we won the Grammy for, I might add.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Congratulations, absolutely.
Yeah, that was exciting.
Well, we're definitely going to be playing, you know, big excerpts from that CD.
Great.
But I wanted to ask you, did he talk to you about his relationship, both musical and personal, with people like Gaither Carlton, Clarence Ashley, Gwen Foster, all that crew, that old crew?
Quite a lot. We've, you know, that's the era that interests me. And we have talked about that a lot. Of course, Gaither was his father-in-law.
Right,
and
yeah.
It was kind of through Gaither that he met Rosalie, his wife.
Yeah.
And
well, I definitely encourage everybody to check out that early 20s era Clarence Ashley, Carolina Tar Heels band stuff. Instead, let's hear some stuff from Doc Watson's family. We'll hear The Lone Pilgrim with Doc Watson singing it on playing guitar and his father-in-law, Gaither Carlton, playing the fiddle part. Then we'll hear Gaither on banjo singing Oh Me Let Your Bangs Roll Down. And finally, a beautiful piece called Your Long Journey, which is Doc Watson singing together with his wife, Rosalie. I love that song. It's really one of my favorites. Lone Pilgrim and Long Journey are taken from a CD called The Watson Family, which was first issued as an LP back in the 60s. And Gaither's Oh Me Let Your Bangs Roll Down is from a CD called Clawhammer Banjo, Volume 2. Here's The Lone Pilgrim.
Thank you. a lizard in the spring. Yes, I wish I was a lizard in the spring. Was a lizard in the spring, I could hear my darling sing. And I wish I was a lizard in the spring.
First played together when he was 18, and they would do these land sales. They would go around and the land auctioneer would have a little music, you know, to attract a crowd and kind of entertain the people. And those guys, Doc and Clarence Ashley, would play for that. And so when Ralph Rinsler came down and was looking for Clarence Ashley, because Clarence had recorded that Cuckoo song back in the 1920s.
I played that at CBGB's last night.
Oh, that's great. Oh, yeah, isn't that a great song?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Great, people love it. You know, it's the Cuckoo, although I'm considering doing changing it into the Emu.
That'd be more modern, wouldn't it?
You know, yeah, in a certain sense.
It's that song. It's in some ways responsible for the discovery of Doc Watson, because Ralph Rinsler found Clarence Ashley and then said, "You know, you got to have a guitar player with you." And Clarence said, "Well, I used to play with this blind boy."
Sure.
And that's how he found Doc.
That's excellent. And of course, Doc, I guess he at that time, I heard he was playing like rockabilly in addition, or just in exclusion of the older like folk stuff.
Well, actually, it wasn't so much that. He was playing electric guitar. You're right about that. He had a Les Paul. But he was playing in a square dance band with fiddler. And so that's how he got to be such a great flat picker, because he played the tunes on the electric guitar, you know, tunes like Ragtime Annie and all that.
Yeah.
He worked them up on the guitar. And then in the breaks of the dancing, they would do some rockabilly-type stuff. But it wasn't a performance band as much as it was a dance band with some interludes of you know, they played everything from Stardust to Great Balls of Fire.
Right.
So they did it all.
That's really interesting. I'd never heard that before.
Yeah, it's kind of an incredible thing. He still has that beautiful guitar.
What did he play? I mean, that they had electricity and everything for these. Then what kind of amp did he play through?
He said he had a Fender. I think it was a Fender Twin, something like that.
Wow.
But he wouldn't play it very loud, he said. You know, they wouldn't blast away, because he had a piano, bass, drums, and the electric guitar, and sometimes a girl singer.
Wow.
And then Doc would sing too. So he'd even croon some of these, you know, Eddie Arnold type things.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah.
But he knew all the folk stuff too, because that was part, you know, that was his community and that was the music he loved. They got a 78 recording player when he was a kid. I mean, a 78 record player when he was a kid.
Yeah.
And that's how he learned most of his music, actually, from those old 78s.
Okay. Wow. Yeah. Well, what was he listening to? Well, wait, let's pause this interview and hear David Holt ask Doc Watson that same question. This from their Legacy CD that they did together. It's really great. I'm going to be able to play a bunch of it on this show, but it's really, go out and get it, because you definitely want to hear the whole thing.
Tell us about how that Victrola came into your house.
Well, my two oldest brothers and my dad were working for my uncle, one of Mama's brothers, who owned a sawmill at the time, and Uncle Jerome had bought him a big old floor model Victrola, and he had a small one that he wanted to sell. He mentioned something to Dad about it, and Dad said, "I'd like to buy that thing. What do you think for it?" And he said, "Well, if you and the boys got time, you ain't push for money." He said, "If you want to work a week for him at the sawmill, you can have it. And there's 50 records that goes with it." And Dad said, "I believe we'll do that." And him and I think I worked 4 days. It wasn't a full week or something. And Dad come carrying it in. I thought we had the king's treasure.
I bet you did. What were some of the records that came with it?
Oh, there's a whole bunch. I'll name you one or two.
Yeah.
There's some. I'll just sprinkle through it and tell you the kinds we had. We had some blues recordings by people like John Hurt and Furry Lewis. We had a couple of Memphis Jug Band, Cannon's Jug Stompers. And then there was a Dixieland jazz record or two, one or two of the Skillet Lickers recordings, Clayton McMitchin and Gid Tanner. And then there was a few good old gospel records, Smith's Sacred Singers.
Whatever happened to those records?
We wore them out, every one of them. The last one, I found one in some old recordings I had, and it wasn't even worth keeping. It was so worn you couldn't even hear the words or half the music. I just got rid of it. I hated to part with it, but if it would have still played, I would have kept it.
Was that your main musical influence when you were a kid?
It had to have been. No, something came before that, David, the old-time gospel music that they sang at the church, unaccompanied, of course. My first memory of music as such, I was sitting on Mother's lap, I must have been about two or three, was hearing them sing songs like There Is a Fountain and the old Lone Pilgrim, songs of that kind.
Singing in church, and I guess you sang them as well.
Yeah.
In fact, your dad was a singing teacher, wasn't he?
He was a singing leader at the church. Rosalie's grandfather, T.S. Robbins, was the singing teacher. Dad was a singing leader at the church. And Mr. Robbins taught singing schools every year in August. He was pastor of the church at that time. When the crops was laid by, as they put it, in August, he always teach a 1 week singing school.
Well, let's hear Doc play and sing one that he learned right off the record. Frank Hutchinson's That Train That Carried My Girl From Town. The intro is taken from the Legacy CD, but then I couldn't resist using the version that he does on the Watson Family album from back in 63. It's so good. And first, why not let's hear a little snippet of Frank Hutchinson's original That Train That Carried My Girl From Town. Here it goes.
Tell them about The Train That Carried My Girl From Town while I get this thing ready.
One of those records that was with that first little wind-up Victrola we got was a record by Frank Hutchins, had Worried Blues on one side and Train That Carried My Girl From Town on the other side. I heard that said that Frank played with a big heavy pocket knife instead of a bar up here. I don't know. Wade Maynard did, I know.
Where was you when the train left town? I stand on the corner with my head hung down. Hey, that train carried my girl from town. Hey, 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 hey. I wish to the Lord that train would wreck, kill the engineer and break the fireman's neck. Hey, that train done carried my girl from town. Hey, 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 hey. Rations on the table, coffee's getting cold, some dirty around the stove, my jelly roll. Hey, that train and carried my girl from town. Hey, 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 hey. There goes my girl, somebody bring her back, cause she's got her hand in my money sack. Hey, that train and carried my girl from town. Hey, 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 hey. Oh, she rolled on down the line now. Ashes to ashes and dust to dust. Lord, show me the woman that a man can trust. Hey, that train and carried my girl from town. Hey, hey, hey. Tough to make a man alone. Oh, yeah. That's the way she sounded when she went out of here.
So he would play those things over and over because he couldn't get out and drive, of course, and couldn't go to other musicians' house. So that's the way he learned a lot, by just sitting and listening to that. And he had such an unbelievable capacity for listening and learning that he was able just to pick it up off the record.
So in a sense, he was able to learn from African-American musicians through records. Did he have personal contact with African-American musicians in his area?
No, I don't think so. I should ask him when the first time he met an African-American person. There were probably some folks in Boone, but not many, you know. I mean, Boone was a mountain town at that time. There probably weren't many African-American people around there. Well, I have to ask him that, but he did definitely learn off the records. He loved the blues. The blues was, of course, very popular then. Jimmy Rogers and all those guys were doing the blue yodels, and so blues was in its heyday in some ways in the 30s.
Sure. What was Doc's first instrument?
Harmonica.
Okay, that's I think kind of common actually.
Yeah, he got because it was 25 cents.
Dad was a harmonica player, and he played quite a few of the old breakdowns, and he was a singing leader in the church. And when he got me my first little harmonica, was it Christmas time one year, I believe, and he was going to show me how to play something on it.
How old were you?
I must have been 5 or 6, something like that, just before we got that wind-up Victrola.
Mm-hmm. So your dad gave you that harmonica?
It was a C, too, and he said, "Now, son, this thing got notes on it, just like the ones you hear me sing in the songbook, like, do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do." And then he played the scale, sort of. And I said, "Now, some of them you push and some of them you pull," and then laughed. Said, "You learn to play a tune like Home Sweet Home, single note first." And then he said, "Once you get to where you can find the notes on there pretty good, then you can start noting it with your tongue like I do." He said, "It'll sound like this when you first learn how to play it single note." And then when you learn to note it with your tongue, it sounds like this.
Play another old straight harp tune that he might have played.
I'll play you Sally Gooden. How's that?
Great art playing, Doc. Was your dad that good?
Well, just about.
Wow. Huh. Did you ever play with other people on the harmonica?
I don't remember. I don't think Dad ever played any with anybody. Just played some around the house.
And did you ever play with any other musicians?
Oh, yeah. A little later on, I did, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think I played the harmonica some with my cousin Spencer Miller, played the banjo as well as the harp, and I played the harp a little bit with him.
Mm-hmm. Of course, now that's what we call the straight harp. And yeah. Then later on, I guess it was later on, you learned the blues harp. How did you learn that?
From Spencer. Hmm. And I first learned it as a breakdown, believe it or not, as a blues.
How do you think he learned it up here in the mountains?
Listening to the records and figured it out, I guess. By the time I was big enough to really begin to listen to the harmonica, everybody had a little wind-up Victrola in the house just about that could afford it at all, you know. And right. His folks had one. They loved the blues as good as we did. Swing Low, Sweet Chariot.
That's a good one.
That's about as blues as you can get to be a spiritual.
That's true. What was your mom's name?
Annie Watson, Nancy Ann. Uh-huh. And some of her brothers called her Nanny, but Dad called her Annie all the time.
She must have been really busy keeping up with 9 children.
Too busy to learn to play the guitar. She sang a few of the good old time ballads and things like that, and some of the good old hymns around the house, but she had her hands full, I can tell you.
Did you help her with the younger kids?
I've rocked many a baby to sleep. My 2 youngest sisters, I reckon I did my share in that.
When you were growing up here, what was it like in the mountains in those days? Of course, Boone is built up now, but in those days, it must have been quite rural.
It certainly was. One of the wonderful things I remember, besides enjoying walking the good country roads, I really enjoyed that, even in the hot weather or the cold, was the good fresh air that's not quite like it was then. And certain little plants and things that are almost extinct, everything would begin to come out in the summer, it was wonderful. You walk along the roads and you just enjoyed being alive. I still do that out in the countryside, but I miss some of it now. See, I wouldn't dare try to walk to Boone now.
No, that would be tough.
Too much traffic.
So you can tell the difference in the air?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
How about the number of birds?
Oh, lots of the birds are extinct. The old-fashioned mockingbird, there used to be hundreds of them around these mountains when I was still going to school over at Raleigh in the 30s. I hadn't heard one in years. I don't. And the whippoorwill, I never hear those anymore.
Were you a mischievous kid?
I remember once I got a pretty good spanking, not a real dangerous one, for scratching a record real bad on the Victrola before I got big enough to play it myself. And I learned better until I got older and they showed me how to do it and let me try it. I was about six, I guess, when I reached up and pulled the needle right across the record. Womp! I remember that yet, clear as yesterday.
And then when he was 10, his dad made him this very funky homemade catskin head banjo, fretless banjo. I mean, carved it, you know, just it's an incredible looking thing. And hard to play, I might add. And his dad played a little on that and showed him some of the Ramblin' Hobo and some of those tunes. And
wow.
Doc learned to play that. Took that down to the blind school. So he didn't go to school till he was 10.
Okay.
And took that down to the blind school, and there was a guy there who had a nice guitar, and Doc would let him play the banjo if he would let him play the guitar, and this fellow showed Doc the chords. Two blind guys, you know, showing each other how to play music. Pretty amazing.
That is really amazing. Wow. That's excellent. Well, let's hear Doc play some banjo. Well, here are two of those early tunes that his father showed him. First, Rambling Hobo, and then Reuben's Train. Two great old-time banjo tunes.
In 1934, my dad made me a little homemade banjo, fretless, and it didn't look quite as pretty and shiny as this one. And the first tune I ever heard him play on it was a tune that he called Rambling Hobo.
Tell us about how you got the first banjo.
In 1934, Dad made me a little homemade banjo. Had a cat skin head on it. First, he put a groundhog skin head on it, and it was too thick. It didn't work good. He was splitting stove wood. And I was getting me a big armful to take in the house to put in the wood box for Mama. And my brother come up through the yard with something in a little sack and a big bucket of water in the other hand, and Dad said, Lenny, what you got in that sack? He said, I got Granny's poor old cat that's got too old to live any longer, and she wanted me to put it out of its misery. And I told her I couldn't do it, and she said, son, I'll give you 50 cents if you will. I just ain't got the heart. It couldn't see and it couldn't eat. So Dad thought about it a minute, and he said, I seen a Joe Rogers advertisement in Sears Roebuck for a banjo head. If you boys will skin that thing, I'll make you a banjo head out of it. Well, we both dreaded it, but Lenny said, well, I bet that would sound good. I bet that'd be as clear as you could read a paper through it when Dad gets done with it. And between Dad and Lenny, they got that thing right and all the hair off of it. It was just about clear. When it's had a beautiful sound, too.
Did your dad play the banjo?
Yes, he did. And when he got it made, he began to tune it up. I said, Papa, can you pick that thing? He said, a little bit. He said, I believe I can play you a tune on it. Would you like to hear the first tune he picked for me?
I would.
It won't sound like the fretless now. He said, now I'm going to play Reuben's Train for you, and I'll show you how it blows somewhere down in the middle. And I can't do the fretless slide, but I'll show you what he did.
When he played, and then how did you even know how to hold it and how to play it with your right hand?
He showed me.
Uh-huh.
But it was a while. Now, wait a minute. Just let me clue you, as they say right here. It was a while before I learned how to frail.
Sure. I mean, it took some practice.
Yeah. Dad had another little style he did on the banjo. Lot easier than what I just did.
A little two-finger stuff.
Yeah.
Rambling Hobo is taken from the Watson Family, the LP that came out in 1963, and then the interview and performance of Reuben's Train was taken from the Legacy CD set, which was issued in 2002. Well, I could ask you this stuff all day, but instead I think we'll play from the record.
Yeah.
And move on, shift a little bit. Now, I wanted to ask you about your reflections on O Brother, Where Art Thou?
Mm-hmm.
Everyone still talks about that movie when you mention old time or folk music and all that. Of course, you were in that movie as one of the musicians.
Yeah.
What was the feeling like on the set?
You know, it was really great. This was the time before George Clooney was really famous. He had just finished ER, so people knew him from TV. He hadn't even done the movie Out of Sight yet, I don't think. I think that was his first movie.
Okay.
So he was, I think he still is a really great guy, but he was very loose, and we had to stay up all night to film the part I'm in. I'm in one of the last scenes in the movie where we're taking Babyface Nelson to the electric chair, and I'm leading the parade, playing, Ed Snodderly's playing fiddle, I'm playing mandolin, acting crazy. And you know, we basically had the entire evening from 5 p.m. to 5 a.m. before they shot this scene. And they were shooting other peripheral scenes. And so we just sort of sat around the trailers back there with T-Bone and all the actors and Clooney and Nelson and all those guys.
Yep.
And sat around and sang old songs because they had really boned up on the old songs because they knew that that was a big part of the movie.
Okay, yeah.
And so, you know, Clooney likes to sing anyway, and so he was a very entertaining guy, and we just had a blast sitting out there.
Yeah.
And when I saw them shoot the movie, I thought, oh, this is never going to go anywhere, you know. This is just going to be a silly movie. And then when I saw it all edited together, this is great, you know, just...
That's excellent.
It
yeah,
really
I guess
hit on something.
George Clooney, he has music in the family. I guess his aunt was Rosemary Clooney.
That's
the,
right.
The 40s sort of pop singer, yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
I was wondering about that. So people, you know, that were in the movie had the sense that they were, you know, that they were part of something, that they were doing something, you know, that had to do with the music.
That was definitely true. I mean, the music was an essential part of it, and they knew that was going to be all the way through. And they knew they were portraying a band, of course. But the thing that comes through in that movie that was on the set is everybody was just cutting up and just having a big time. It wasn't a serious set. Everybody was in a great mood, and I think that added to the whole thing. Just the sense of everybody feeling together and making everyone feel at home. And the Coen brothers are just great. They just look like, you know, hippies from the 60s, you know, and they're not big... Hollywood guys. They're just great guys, and they love old-time music. They love blues.
Oh, that's
great. I really loved talking to them and working with them. Well, they were on the set, of course.
I liked it that Mac McClintock had a song on there, the old IWW guy with his song on the soundtrack. That was just wonderful.
Yeah, Haywire, Mac McClintock. What was the song? Let's see.
Well, Big Rock Candy Mountain.
Big Rock
on
Candy
there,
Mountain.
But,
that's
yeah.
The one. Yep.
Yeah, but he had a bunch of good ones. I guess. Well, I'm gonna have to play some Haywire Mac on this show.
Hallelujah! Definitely. I'm a bum. That's a good one.
Yeah. Is. Yeah. All right. Wait. Let's put the interview on pause. Harry McClintock was a great old cowboy singer and one of the musicians associated with the IWW, International Workers of the World. The Wobblies knew Joe Hill fairly well, or as well as anyone knew Joe Hill, apparently. And I'm going to play a version of Big Rock Candy Mountain, not from the Old Brother soundtrack, but from a record from 1950 that a guy named Sam Eskin did, and he interviews Mac McClintock, so you'll actually get to hear him talk about the song Big Rock Candy Mountain.
The song, originally, I wrote it when I was a kid, and it was the fairy stories. At that time, the ambition of every real hobo was to snare some kid to do his begging for him, among other things. And they used to tell the kids fairy stories about the lemonade springs and the Big Rock Candy Mountains and so forth. And there was some foundation. In fact, now, for instance, in Soda Springs, Idaho, there were at that time, and I guess still are, springs there that are so strongly, the water is so strong with soda that all you need is to a glass of water out of one of those springs and sprinkle a little lemon juice in it, and you have a very fine glass of soda water. And in Salt Lake City, not far from the OSL freight yards there, there's what was known as the chicken soup springs. It has some sort of a chemical content. It was a great place for the hobos to boil up or wash their clothes. And also the water had a sort of a flavor, you know. It might have been chicken soup. And in other words, there was a little foundation for the idea. But when I wanted to clean this song up, it wasn't a parlor song originally.
Well, do you remember what it was originally?
Yeah.
Well, how about singing the way it was originally, and then we'll do the clean version later.
Well, wait a minute. I don't believe I could do it offhand, Sam. I'd have to do a bit of thinking on that. I'll do the clean version.
All right. You do the clean version, and then we'll do the other. Now, look, Mac. Okay. Do I get this right? That you made this song?
That is right.
That's right.
It isn't the version that's used by Burl Ives. Burl Ives used some of my lyrics in his number. Or whoever wrote it, I don't know whether Burl Ives wrote that that version or not, but it is not, although some of my lyrics are used in there.
Well, sing your version of it then.
Well, the clean one.
The clean one.
Yeah. One evening as the sun went down and the jungle fire was burning, down the track came a hobo hiking, and he said, "Boys, I'm not turning. I'm headed for a land that's far away beside the crystal fountains. So come with me, we'll go and see the Big Rock Candy Mountains. In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, there's a land that's fair and bright, where the handouts grow on bushes and you sleep out every night, where the boxcars all are empty and the sun shines every day on the birds and the bees and the cigarette trees and the lemonade springs, where the bluebird sings in the Big Rock Candy Mountains. In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, all the cops have wooden legs, and the bulldogs all have rubber teeth, and the hens lay soft-boiled eggs. There the farmer's trees are full of fruit, and the barns are full of hay. And I'm bound to go where there ain't no snow, and the rain don't fall, and the wind don't blow, in the Big Rock Candy Mountains. In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, you never change your socks, and the little streams of alcohol come trickling down the rocks. There ain't no short-handled shovels, no axes, spades, or picks, and I'm bound to stay where they sleep all day, where they hung the Turk that invented work, in the Big Rock Candy Mountains. In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, all the jails are made of tin, and you can walk right out again as soon as you are in. Why, the brakemen have to tip their hats, and the railroad bulls are blind. There's a lake of stew and a gin lake too. You can paddle all around them in a big canoe in the Big Rock Candy Mountain.
That's... He was one of those cowboy singers I loved in those early days.
Yeah, he was. I mean, he was definitely not unknown. He had, you know, he made, Joe Hill never made records, but he made records.
He made records, and I believe, if I'm not incorrect, he had he was on the radio a lot too.
Oh, really? Okay.
McClintock. Yeah, he was fairly well known.
Yeah, definitely. Now Nimrod Workman, could you tell the listeners about him? Because I really need to get some Nimrod Workman on this program.
Nimrod was a coal miner, had black lung, smoked unfiltered Camel cigarettes, and lived to be 98 years old. That's what kind of a guy he was. He
Good
was,
for him.
You know, sturdy and just an absolute character. Sang these old ballads unaccompanied, wrote coal mining songs. He had been a coal miner and had been through the some of the Harlan, you know, County coal strike and all that. He had been through a lot and seen a lot, and he brought that to his music. He was a very powerful old guy.
Yeah, definitely. And he, of course, he was a union guy too, right?
Big union guy. Yeah. He of course, in those days, you know, if you weren't part of the union in the coal mines, man, they were just going to stamp all over you and stepped all over you anyway, the big coal companies.
Well, yeah, sure.
In those days. And so being a union man was a matter of survival.
Definitely. Yeah. And he was an unaccompanied ballad singer?
Yeah. You could try to play along with him, but he would always just... He had his own rules about timing, and
right.
So it was always... a challenge to play with him, but fun. But his best stuff was really the old unaccompanied ballads.
Let me play a Nimrod Workman track now. He's really one of the awesome great characters, and I'm going to do a whole show on him for sure. Obviously, it's tough to choose which track of his to play, but for the time being, I'll just play a track called Coal Black Mining Blues that he recorded and was featured in the film Harlan County, USA, the great movie about the Harlan County mine wars. Definitely check that out. So here's Nimrod Workman with Coal Black Mining Blues.
This song that I composed, that Coal Black Mining Blues, an old guy he was working in iron, he'd take a man trip, cut it off, push it in his place and load it up in coal. And you couldn't get him out at all, hardly. Kel Dowden was braking on a motor. Enos Markham, he was running the motor. And I composed this song, and they fired a guy off in the temple trying to put a scab on, you know, trying to break the union up. And I composed this song on Enos and Kel. And Herb was the guy that would load the coal. I got the blues, got the blues, Lord, Lord, coal black, mining blues. Went to my place and I peeped in, flayed in the water up to my chin. I got the blues, got the blues, got the blues, Lord, Lord, coal black, mining blues. I looked at old Jim, Jim looked sad. The worst darn place that I ever had. I got the blues, I got the blues, I got the blues, Lord, Lord. Coal black, mining blues. Sent me to the office to look at the roll. Chilton counted up $9 in the hole. I got the blues, I got the blues, I got the blues, Lord, Lord. Coal black, mining blues. Telling me it's on a pardon. Half a page four. Herb's in the head and then he wants four more. Got the blues, got the blues, got the blues, Lord, Lord. Coal black, mining blues. Bask him at the bottom, a dipping up sand. Long come short, he says, I got another man. You got the blues, you got the blues, you got the blues, Lord, Lord. Coal black, mining blues. Herb on the tipple, singing a song. Get gone, hurry, cause whims are coming on. You got the blues, you got the blues, you got the blues, Lord, Lord. Coal black, mining blues.
How did you come into contact with him?
Let's see, in those days, the Apple shop in Whitesburg, Kentucky was getting going.
Sure, yeah.
They actually made my first record. It was a vinyl record called It Just Suits Me, and so there was quite a crew: John McCutcheon, me, Nimrod, quite a few different folks, Lee Sexton. You know, up there in going up there a lot and working with those people. They really were doing some creative things in those early '60s, late '70s.
That's great. Yeah, we're
and still are
definitely. We're hoping to have, you know, people from there on the program. Maybe possibly you could put us in touch. Maybe that would be excellent.
I'd be happy to.
Cool. Yeah, he's definitely a favorite of mine. So I'll be playing his stuff on this show as well. I read that this guy had like a nation. You know, he had like 13 kids and like 80 grandchildren.
Yes, having a nation is about right. He did. One wife. I think it was 13. I think you're right. Something like that.
That's really excellent. So do you and Doc continue to play together?
Yeah, we're playing this weekend, as a matter of fact.
Oh, wow.
We play probably three times a month, go out for two or three weekends, play, let's see, we just came back from Ithaca, New York, and Scranton, PA, and we're going out to Seattle here in a couple of weeks, and Portland. So yeah, we pretty much still travel and do the show. He's 83.
Yeah.
We travel with his grandson Richard, who plays with us, and
yep.
And on stage we do the, you know, play a lot of great music and do the interviewing, and it's a neat show. And then I also play solo a lot and have a band now called David Holt and the Lightning Bolts, which I will get you a CD of that. It's a really great group with some of our best Western North Carolina musicians. So
that's
pretty dang busy.
That's great. Well, yeah, I'm very happy that you're keeping busy. You're doing great work. And thank you so much for being on Down Home Radio.
Great. People want to look at the stuff. It's my website is davidholt.com.
All right.
All right.
Well, that does it for today's program. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to check our website, downhomeradioshow.com, for more information on this show. And I'm going to put together a bunch of links for this show because there was a lot of stuff that was talked about and mentioned that I didn't get a chance to really go into. So definitely check out the links. And we'll be back again next week for another edition of Down Home Radio.
Now let's both of us play the